It's a powerful and painful emotion. We've all felt it, but some have felt it so deeply that it threatens to destroy them. Shame. This emotion can be a curse. Today, we're going to explore its origins and then turn to the Bible to discover God's answer to the curse of shame. If shame has ever paralyzed you or someone you know, please stay with us. From the Moody Church in Chicago, this is Running to Win with Dr. Erwin Lutzer, whose clear teaching helps us make it across the finish line. Our current series explains why good people do bad things. Turn with us to Genesis chapter 2 as Dr. Lutzer talks about the curse and cure of shame.
You know, even if you can't define the word shame, all of us have felt it. Because all of us have done things of which we are ashamed. Shame is that feeling that we have radically disappointed ourselves, radically disappointed our friends, and radically disappointed God. As a matter of fact, shame is a very painful emotion, as we're going to discover. It is so painful that people will do anything to avoid it. But shame was not a part of the original creation. If you have your Bibles, turn to Genesis chapter 2, where we shall be looking at chapter 2 and also briefly to chapter 3, where it said that after God created Adam and Eve, verse 25 of chapter 2, the man and his wife were both naked, and they felt no shame. No shame. I want you to imagine what that would be like. Imagine being psychologically available and transparent, psychologically vulnerable, and have nothing in your life of which you are ashamed, not a single thought that you know will elicit disappointment if someone else knows about it. Men, think for a moment of having a mind that is so pure that your mother and your sister and your wife can know every single thought you think and approve of it, and there's no possibility of disapproval. You women, think of what it would be like to have aspirations that are so holy, so consistent, that your friends and your husband and everyone, the whole wide world, can know what it is that you are thinking, know what it is that you are aspiring to, and yet there is nothing of which you need to be ashamed. No possibility of resentments, of bitterness, of grudges that are nursed, of lusts. Wow, what a life that must be. Adam and Eve, naively, gloriously free and transparent. They knew no shame. But sin changed all that, of course. We find out that after they sinned, it says that the eyes of them were both opened. This is verse 7 of chapter 3. And they sewed fig leaves together and made covering for themselves. They were hiding their shame. You know, when sin entered into the world, what happened is the serpent said that you will be like God, and there's a part of us that is God-like. There was some truth in what he said, though he really misled them, and much of what he said was totally false, of course. But now what's going to happen is, as a result of the fall, I will be my little God over my little sphere of influence, my universe. You will be your God over your fiefdom, your little sphere of influence, and we as gods now are always going to be colliding. Narcissism was born here. You know that Narcissus, it is said in Greek legend, was the man who was good looking. He was so handsome, and the girls were falling in love with him, but he paid no attention to them because he was in love with himself. He saw his reflection in a pool of water, and he so fell in love with it that the gods condemned him to self-love forever, and he died looking at himself, totally self-absorbed. That's narcissism. And it exists in all of us. But those who particularly have a narcissistic personality, they are going to interpret now all reality in relation to themselves. Let me give you a little dialogue with a narcissist. You say, you know, Mrs. Jones down the street, she's the one that baked that cake. It was so good. Well, don't you like the cakes I bake? What's wrong with the ones that I bake? Why is it that you're talking about hers and you never talk about mine? You may say, I need to work late tonight. Oh, I know, you never want to be with me, do you? You're always finding an excuse to be out of the home. Or you may say, you know, so-and-so had a great tragedy, and we should really show them kindness. I'm just so grieved by what they're going through. Well, nobody ever cares about me when I'm going through a difficult time. I could go on and on, couldn't I? Another example. Somebody does something evil, and you express the fact that, you know, you're really sorry that this happened. Well, you know, that's something that I wouldn't do. I do many things, but I would never do that. All of reality poured through the self. Now let's understand this. I'm king of my little world, you're king of your little world, okay? And our worlds are constantly colliding. And now left to my natural desires, if you show me up and are better at something than I am, I will resent you. If I see that you are a threat to who I am, I will destroy you. I will blame you. I will tell lies about you. If you have something that I want and I can't seem to have it, I will think of a way to steal it from you. At all costs, I am going to protect my little kingdom, and you're going to protect your little kingdom. And the problem is our kingdoms are always intersecting. They're always bumping into one another. And wars and disputes and lies, all to protect my territory. Well, what happened as a result of this sin that Adam and Eve committed? Let's look at the text now and realize that now that they were king of their own little mountain, number one, they hid. I read it a moment ago. They sowed fig leaves and they hid amongst the trees of the garden. The very trees that were to provide a window into God's character, a window through which they could see the God of nature, becomes now a wall that is going to protect them from themselves and from God. Now, all hiding is not wrong. It was good that they sowed fig leaves to hide themselves. As a matter of fact, later on in this chapter, we find that God himself made garments for them, verse 21, garments of skin to clothe themselves, prefiguring salvation, actually. God did that because there's no going back to paradise. Total exposure now becomes impossible. One day on a plane, I read a book review of someone who wrote a book about the fact that he is the most honest man in the world and he's into total, complete honesty. So if he meets you, he's just plain honest. He might say to you, you know, I've never met you before, but I just want you to know that your breath is a little off. Or he'll meet you and say, you know, I just don't think that the combination that you are wearing today really suits you very well, and you should have chosen something else. Because he's going to be really honest. He also joined a nudist colony because the whole idea is that if he can be physically exposed, he can be psychologically exposed, because he's going to be totally transparent. The Bible would say that that is very wrong-headed. You know why? There is no way to go back to paradise. You can't go back to the Garden of Eden. It is good that there are some things that are not exposed. Quite frankly, I'm glad that you don't know all the thoughts that I have. And I'm very glad that I don't know all the thoughts that you have. And love covers a multitude of sins. And so not everything should be exposed, but there is much that people hide that should be exposed. The Bible says, he who covers his sin will not prosper, but he who confesses and forsakes them finds mercy. And we'll be touching on that a little later on in another message. Secondly, not only did they hide, but secondly, now they are preoccupied with appearance. From now on, the kind of fig leaves that you are wearing is going to be very, very important, because you want to both hide yourselves from others and you want to expose a part of yourself to others. And people are going to be obsessed with the way in which they appear in the sight of others. And you're going to have young women who are very thin, starving themselves to death because of shame. They fear that they are fat, when in point of fact they aren't, and they are going to be obsessed with the way in which they look, particularly in cultures that seem to have little else to do than to be preoccupied with the worship of the body. So now it's going to be important, your appearance, the curves that you have, the muscles that you have or don't have, the way you come across, the cosmetic industry. Everything is now going to be on top alert now that people are going to be preoccupied by the way in which they live in the presence of others. Thirdly, the blame game begins. We already have noticed this in other contexts, that when God says, Adam, bo bis du, and that just happened to slip out, by the way, because I think that God did speak German in the Garden of Eden. But God says, Adam, where are you? And you'll notice he says, I was afraid, and I was naked, and I hid. And who told you that you were naked? Have you eaten of the tree whereof I commanded you that you should not eat? And he said, the woman whom you put here, whom you gave me, she took of the tree, and then I ate. Eve also admits to eating, but she blames it on the serpent. From now on, what you're going to have is a defense mechanism set up within the human psyche that is going to say, I'm not responsible, you are responsible, and there are some people, as we shall learn this morning, who are psychologically incapable of taking responsibility for their mistakes, their misdemeanors, and their sins, and they will, through ingenious ways, if necessary, destroy all the people around them to protect themselves from all possibility of exposure. That's going to happen. Albert Camus said in his book, The Fall, each of us insists on being innocent at all costs, even if he has to accuse the whole human race and heaven itself. Marital difficulties are going to escalate. Notice that the man blames the woman and Eve is not amused. Can you imagine? The Bible doesn't tell us everything, but I can't believe that there was no argument that night. What do you mean? What do you mean? You're saying that I'm the one that gave it to you. You were standing right there, for heaven's sake. Well, yeah, but you're the one who did it, you know. And on it goes. And pretty soon they have to sign up with Pastor Milko for a marriage counseling class. And so it is, and we've all been there, haven't we? In fact, those of us who are married, or even if we aren't married, we know how easily we fall into the sin of self-justification. We know how easily we begin to argue to defend ourselves and make excuses for our behavior and implicate others while we ourselves try to remain very innocent. Yes, it is true that the heart of man is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. The good news, though, is this. First of all, that God is able to save us and to forgive us. And second, that He's able to change us. Let's make sure that He has permission in our lives to do both.
Dr. Erwin Lutzer with part one of The Curse and Cure of Shame, another message in a series on why good people do bad things. Running to Win comes to you from the Moody Church in Chicago. You're hearing Why Good People Do Bad Things. This series is now a book, which we'd like to send as our thank you when you give a gift of any amount to support Running to Win. Just call us at 1-800-215-5001. That's 1-800-215-5001. Online, go to offerrtw.com. That's offerrtw, all one word, .com. Or write to Running to Win at Box 11174, Chicago, Illinois, 60611. This is Dave McAllister. Join us for tomorrow's Running to Win.